It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer Kent. Have you ever been hacked? When you or I get hacked, we might have to go through the hassle of canceling our credit cards, disputing the charges, getting a credit freeze, changing our passwords. But when large companies get hacked, they may have to rebuild their entire digital infrastructure. Whole supply chains can be disrupted, millions of consumers affected when their personal financial data gets dumped online. Remember Equifax? But when governments get hacked, water and power supplies can be at risk. Given these threats, you would think that businesses would be doing everything they could to identify and fix problems, and that governments would want these problems solved. But according to our next guest, you would be wrong. How concerned are you about cybersecurity? Have you ever been hacked? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest this morning is Nicole Perlroth, a cybersecurity journalist for the New York Times. Her new book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Good morning, Nicole.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad you could join us. And I want to talk first about SolarWinds, given the news this week that our own Department of Homeland Security was compromised in that attack last year. What can you tell us about the latest developments?
Well, the latest developments is that we're just learning a little bit more about what these hackers were after. In some ways, it's good news that they were, this was a classic espionage attack. This wasn't a destructive attack. We believe that this was Russia. We haven't seen evidence that calls out individual names or a specific intelligence group. But the leading theory here is that this may have been the SVR, which is one of the most advanced Russian cyber intelligence units. And the SVR, we know in the past, is really known for being more of quiet spies who get into these systems to steal policy documents and emails and that kind of thing. And so we know that they stole emails at the Department of Energy. We know that they successfully broke into some of the Department of Energy's nuclear labs. But we don't think that this was aimed at destruction, which is another worst-case scenario.
Do we know what they were after, what the point was?
Yeah, we think this was spying. We think that we don't know exactly what they were looking for, but this was a really broad operation. We know that they got into 9 U.S. government agencies. I don't know what they were looking to do, but I think it was clear that the timing of this is just very interesting. We were all thinking about the election. This was, we think that they first got in to these government systems around March of 2020 and possibly sooner. And at that time, we were all worried about the election, foreign interference in the election, Russian interference in the election. And it turns out that these groups weren't aimed at the election. They were aimed at our federal IT systems. And they'd been in there for something like 9 months by the time we discovered them. And that gave them 9 months to plant additional backdoors and additional parts of these networks and applications. And it could really be years before we discover every last one of those.
So what could the impact be for us as American citizens?
Well, the impact right now for the Biden administration is that they just inherited communication channels that they cannot trust. So what do you do when everything you're saying, every email you send, every strategy planning document you create could be viewed by an adversary? We don't think they got into classified systems, so that's good. But there's a heck of a lot of sensitive material on these unclassified systems. A good example is BlackStart, which is just a document that the Department of Energy maintains, which is a to-do list of every system that they would pull back online in the event of a mass power outage. And it's a very technical document, and it basically says first we would go to this generator here, then we would go to the substation here, on and on and on and on. But in the hands of an adversary, that's a very dangerous thing because that essentially gives an adversary a hit list of sorts to attack if they wanted to attack the power grid. And over the last 5 years, we have been in this very low-level cyber conflict with Russia, where they have made incursions into our power grid, we have made incursions into their power grid, they have shut the power off in Ukraine, not once, but twice, just for a few hours. But when I went to Ukraine to speak with people for this book, what they said to me was, we were just their test kitchen. This was just a dry run. We believe you're the end target.
Wow. Nicole, we have a call for you. We have Mary in Oshkosh joining us this morning. Good morning, Mary. What was your experience?
Well, about 15 years ago, I had two Google email accounts, Gmail, and one of them was hacked, not very sophisticatedly, because they went and contacted all my contacts saying, "I'm stuck in Spain, send money, please help." But it sent also one to my other email account, and I just happened to be checking my email, and I was never able to get back into the hacked account. And it's made me very careful about not about how I handle online financial things. I'm not one that's willing to use too much of it because after that experience, Google never responded. I never was able to get, any information out of that account again. But anyway, it was sort of funny
Yeah.
that they couldn't even realize that the two accounts, which had such similar names, were the same person.
Connected. Yeah. Oof. Sorry that happened to you, Mary. Nicole, this is how it works, right? Email phishing attempts all over the place.
Yes. And Mary, I'm sighing because what a nightmare, and I'm sorry that happened. I, yes, I mean, phishing, I spend a lot of time in my book talking about advanced nation state threats, but the fact is that something like 80% of the cyber threats we face are conducted through phishing. Someone sends you an email, you click on it, you inadvertently download malware, or you enter your details into a fake login page, and then a cyber criminal uses that to break into your account, and then they use your account to fish other people. And we see this all the time. And all I can say is that the best way to inoculate yourself from that kind of attack is right now, go to your settings. Go to your privacy and security settings and turn on two-factor authentication. And that's just the process by which you get a second password, or sorry, a second code sent to you. You have to log in anytime someone logs into your account from a strange device. And it will knock out most phishing attacks, unless it's an extremely advanced phishing attack, it'll knock out about 80% of the threats that you face. So turn it on your email and turn it on your online banking account. Most banks now make it mandatory. And the other thing I would say that people don't really think about that much is use one browser for all your internet browsing activity and use another one for your email and online banking activity, your sensitive communications, et cetera.
Interesting. Nicole Perlroth is a cybersecurity journalist for the New York Times and the author of This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends: The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with journalist and author Nicole Perlroth, and we're talking cybersecurity. Do you think we're taking cyber threats seriously? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nicole, I want to know more about this attempted hack involving a water treatment plant in a Florida city. Now, it wasn't successful, but what happened?
Well, someone was sitting in front of their computer at a water treatment plant in Oldsmar, Florida. This is just outside Tampa, and actually this was the Friday right before the Super Bowl in Tampa. So an engineer was sitting at his computer, and he saw his cursor move around, only he wasn't moving his hand. And someone started getting into the controls, and even then he didn't think that was that unusual because this is a small water treatment facility. They rely on a network of supervisors and contractors who access these systems remotely. So he didn't think much of it. But then a couple hours later, he saw that same cursor move over to the chemical controls that manage the amount of lye, L-Y-E, in the water and raise the amount of lye in the drinking supply from 100 parts per million to 11,000 parts per million. And had he not been sitting there, there is a chance that he could have, a hacker could have badly contaminated the water supply in Oldsmar, Florida, population something like 15,000, right ahead of the Super Bowl and when hospitals are already overwhelmed with the pandemic. So it would have very much been a terrorist attack. But fortunately, they caught it, and local law enforcement said there were also sensors put in place that might have caught this before that water made its way to the tap. But this is the cyber attack that we worry about. It would really be a silent killer. And we worry about these attacks on these smaller municipal critical infrastructure operators. 80% of our critical infrastructure in the United States is owned and operated and maintained by the private sector. Some of those operators are PG&Es that have the big budgets and resources to essentially have mini intelligence units on staff that can monitor for intrusions, that can track advanced nation state threats, that can block them at the stores. But most are these small municipal operators that don't have those budgets and have to rely on outsiders just to do their day-to-day business. And those outside access points can be exploited by hackers, which is what we saw in this case.
And your book details the rise of the marketplace for these software flaws, for these hacks, these bugs in the system. And I found this so interesting that software is so complex and there are so many people trying to help plug these holes and fix these problems. But yet this whole system of perverse incentives has developed such that some of these hacks do not get fixed, at least not right away. When did you first learn about this marketplace?
Well, there had been murmurings of this marketplace for a while. I used to work at Forbes magazine, and my colleague at Forbes magazine, Andy Greenberg, who covered cybersecurity at the time, wrote this amazing story about this digital broker who traded in flaws in software and the code to exploit them and would trade these to governments. Because at the most basic level, let's say I, a hacker, find a flaw in your iPhone iOS software that Apple doesn't know about. That's called a zero day. And if I, the hacker, know how to write the code that can exploit that flaw to read your text messages, to track your location, to turn on your microphone without you knowing about it or your video. I basically have everything I could possibly need to create an invisible ankle bracelet for you and to spy on everything you do and everyone you meet. And so that capability is of very high value to intelligence agencies and law enforcement in some cases. So there are brokers, zero-day brokers, who readily advertise the prices that they will pay hackers for that capability. And the going rate in the United States from a private broker named Zerodium is $2.5 million for an iOS zero-day exploit. Some other brokers I discovered in the story, like one I discovered called CrowdFence, I learned works exclusively for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and they'll offer a hacker all over the world $3 million for that capability. Now, the trade-off is that if you, the hacker who discovered this, sell it to one of these brokers, you can never tell Apple about it, because the minute Apple learns about the flaw, they will patch it, they will roll that patch into a software update, and you'll get one of those annoying prompts on your iPhone to update your software. And that's why, by the way, it's really important to update your software, because when you do that, you will fix a bug or an exploit that the government just potentially paid $3 million for to spy on people. And so I went and dug into this market, and basically what I learned was that in too many cases, governments are far more incentivized to leave our software more vulnerable than they are to shut these holes down and secure their citizenry.
Nicole, I think about that every time I wake up in the morning and my phone is rebooted and installed an update. I just thought, what has happened? What did they just fix? What did we just near collision?
Now you know. Yeah.
We're speaking with Nicole Perlroth, a cybersecurity journalist for the New York Times. Nicole, why is software so complex and so prone to hacking?
Well, at the most basic level, humans write software. Humans write the code. And alas, we're not perfect. And so we're going to make mistakes. And those mistakes are what form the flaws I just mentioned, 0 days, that can be exploited for any number of purposes. But the problem is, and again, this gets back to our global incentive structures. You know, I just mentioned governments are not necessarily incentivized to fix our vulnerabilities. Well, neither are coders and businesses. I'm sitting here in Silicon Valley, and the operating thesis here for a long time was best vocalized by Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, whose mantra for a long time was move fast and break things and keep shipping. You know, get your product, if it's or code or software, to market first. Grab as much market share as you possibly can before the competition, and you will win. And that is the goal. The goal is not slow down and fix your code and make sure that there's no big glaring bugs in it that could be exploited by a nation state hacker. It's just get this code to market. So as long as we have that market incentive in place, and as long as governments are incentivized to use these holes to spy on terrorists and adversaries all over the world, then there isn't much incentive to get these holes fixed. And even at the individual level, we are not thinking about security as much as we need to. You know, we just want what we want right now on our phones. Password management, creating long different passwords has always been annoying. Turning on two-factor authentication has always been annoying. Security has always been annoying. So my goal in writing this book was to sort of shake us all of our complacency and say, wait a minute, every incentive out there is leading us down a path of further vulnerability. At the same time, nation states and cyber criminals all over the world have seen that the United States has more systems of interest than almost anywhere else. We have more nation state hackers knocking on our doors and windows than ever before in cyberspace. And we might be the most advanced player when it comes to hacking others, hacking other nation states and and keeping tabs on our adversaries. But what people don't realize is that the United States is also the most targeted nation on Earth. And you could argue we are the most vulnerable because we're so digitized, because we've put so much of our lives and critical infrastructure online.
We're connected. All of our devices, so many devices are online, and that creates risk. We're speaking with Nicole Perlroth, New York Times journalist, author of the new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Up next is news. Then we'll continue our conversation about the extent of cybersecurity threats facing us and our government alike. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show on the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking to Nicole Perlroth about her new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. Do you worry that the race to connect so many things to the internet leaves us vulnerable? Have you changed your passwords recently? Not really. Have you? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings if you have a question about cybersecurity for Nicole Perlroth. Well, Nicole, we were just talking about passwords and how software hacks kind of exploit our human nature and not to be able to memorize so many complex passwords. Do we need better solutions than relying on individuals to come up with these long catchphrases and have a different password for every single device? And as you were suggesting earlier, to use different browsers? I mean, that's a lot to ask of millions of citizens. Is there a better way?
I totally agree. And the password model is broken. You know, most of our passwords have already been stolen, and we see that one of the most common vectors for attack these days from cyber criminals, but also nation states like Iran, is called password spraying, where they'll just spray common passwords at sites, and it's remarkably easy for them to break in using that method, and that's why most people try common passwords, because most of us use common passwords. So the password model is broken, but I agree with you that we need to get to a point where it shouldn't be on us, the users, to be coming up with these complicated password protocols. I mean, I have such a complicated personal password algorithm I've developed because I don't even trust password managers, but most people can trust password managers, and password managers can make your life a lot easier and more secure if you use them. But I do think the model is broken, and I hope that very soon we will move to more of the Apple model, you know, where you'll hold a camera up to your face, they'll see it's your face and let you in. But the problem with that, of course, is privacy. You know, do we really want facial recognition out there and available to so many different retailers and data marketers and that kind of thing?
And I want to better understand the U.S. government's role here. One thing you detail extensively in your book is how this whole marketplace developed, how it came to be that you had software engineers, hackers around the world trying to fix problems in software that they saw, you know, initially reporting problems to the companies themselves, often being shunned, maybe threatened with prosecution for bringing up these issues and talking about them. And then as you describe, you started to see this marketplace develop where instead of telling the companies, they were able to start getting money for them. And one of the buyers was the U.S. government. How did this happen?
Yeah, so I was really interested in how this dynamic came to be. I have just been fascinated by this idea that we, the American taxpayer, pay the government to keep us safe, but in a lot of cases, they were paying hackers to leave us more vulnerable. So that was the moral hazard that I really wanted to dig into with my book. But it was very complicated when you go back in history. So just as you laid out, you know, the word hacker has always been construed and sort of unfairly tied to a cyber criminal. And the fact is that a hacker is just someone who is curious, who tests the system and might find a way to use that system for a wholly different purpose. A lot of hackers these days are good guys, are white hats, who are simply probing technology to find flaws to get them fixed. And so for a long time, that's what this was. Hackers would find flaws in software. Back in the 90s, it was Oracle or Sun Microsystems, Microsoft, HP, Hewlett-Packard software and hardware. They would poke around it. They'd find a hole in the system that allowed them to break into another system or steal someone's personal data. And in those days, they would often try and call someone at the company. There was no 1-800 number to call, but they would do some diligence and find out who, what number to dial to reach an engineer or maybe just a front office and go from there. And they would try to call the company's attention to these flaws in their products. But back then, these companies weren't interested in hearing it. So the most common response was just a hang up or to ignore hackers, or in some cases, they would send their general counsel after them to threaten them and say, hey, stop poking around our products or we'll sue you. And in some cases, they actually did sue hackers. So
And this was a service, right? That they essentially they were providing for free to the companies testing their products.
Yes, it's basically free quality control. Now, I do have to admit that back in those days, you know, hackers weren't known for their diplomacy or their customer service skills. So just the corporate culture versus the hacker culture, created sort of a hostile dynamic. But, you know, they were trying to get these holes fixed. And inevitably, you know, they just said, fine, you know, if you don't want our free labor, we're just going to start dumping these online. And that's what happened. There were these hacker forums like BugTrack and Full Disclosure, that's what they were called. And they would dump these flaws on these forums, mostly for street credibility. Sometimes they would trade their knowledge with other hackers who had found something else. You know, it was really just a hobby. But what I learned in the book is that, you know, this was in the 90s. We saw the U.S. Embassy bombings. You know, this was the end of the Cold War, which was good news at first until we realized that we had entered this much more uncertain era where enemies were popping up all over the globe, and we wanted to keep tabs on that. And we, the U.S. government, I should say, saw that what the hackers were doing, finding flaws in commonly used software like Microsoft, had immense intelligence collection value. They could use the flaws that these hackers were publishing on these hacker sites like BugTrack, add code to exploit them, and use them to spy on Russian diplomats at the embassy in Kiev, who they suspected of being intelligence agents. They could use it to spy on terrorists all over the world. And so what I learned in doing this book is that they started reaching out to these hackers who'd been beat over the head for so long by the technology companies. And they started saying to them, listen, if you can develop something unique for us, something that we could use to break into Microsoft software all over the world, we'll pay you $150,000 so long as you never tell a soul. And so began the U.S. participation in the zero-day market. And so I found a zero-day broker from those early days, one of the first, who said that they would reach out to hackers on these forums. They would pay them $150,000 for these holes, and they would develop the code to exploit them, and then they would sell them to U.S. government agencies. Something like 80% of their business was for the Pentagon and intelligence agencies, and then the other 20% was for law enforcement, which saw that they could use these holes to spy on child predators and people they suspected of participating in drug cartels and that kind of thing. So began a very lively trade in software vulnerabilities.
And so to be clear, when they did so, when they purchased these bugs, these exploits, they didn't tell the companies and they didn't attempt to fix them. They held them.
They held them, yes. And sometimes people use the word hoarding, that governments are hoarding these vulnerabilities so they can use them for counterintelligence. But the problem is that we have baked software into so much of our critical infrastructure. You know, we were talking in your last segment about a water treatment facility that was hacked. You know, everything now has software in it. Here in Silicon Valley, venture capitalists like to say software is eating the world, and I cringe every time I hear that, because what they mean is that software is making its way into every part of our digital lives, but also our critical infrastructure, our power grid, et cetera. So governments see that for their own battlefield preparations, it would be helpful to have access points into the power grid of another country in case we wanted to shut down their power or shut down their communication channels in the event of a physical war. And so they're not only hoarding these vulnerabilities for espionage and law enforcement, in some cases they're hoarding them for the future likelihood that they might have to shut off the power in a country one day. And so we're not the only ones doing that here in the United States and our allies. This is something that our adversaries have started to do. They see that the United States is one of the most connected nations on earth, that they will never be able to match us in terms of military might or military budgets. And in cyber, they have found, our soft underbelly. They have found that using a zero day or just doing a rudimentary password spring or phishing attack, they can break into critical systems here in the United States, either for espionage or to shut them down. And over the last 10 years, I've covered Iranian hackers who've been caught mucking around the controls of our dams. I've caught Iranian hackers bringing American banking sites offline. We've seen them decimate data at Sands Casino because they were upset with something that Sheldon Adelson, Sands Casino,
the Pandora's CEO, has said. Box is open now, right? This is why you call it an arms race, right? It's happening all over the world. And we, Nicole, we have a call for you that wants to know more about the power grid. Frank is joining us from La Crosse. Good morning, Frank.
Hello. My question concerns the energy grid, which is obviously well connected but not protected, and the Texas energy fiasco being one example. How does the federal government go about regulating and forcing these profit power companies to upgrade their security to prevent massive power grid shortages, either naturally caused or by hackers? Particularly when the people in charge, the old white men, say in the Congress, don't understand technology?
Such a good question. There's a really good book. I get into this in my book, but there's a really good book about this called Lights Out by Ted Koppel that I highly recommend as well. It's a really sad state when it comes to pressuring utilities to up their security. So 8-9 years ago, there was a bill in Congress that would have set mandatory standards for power grid operators and critical infrastructure operators to meet serious security standards. And unfortunately, the lobbyists came in and they said, this is too costly and too burdensome for these utilities, for these mom and pop utilities, municipal utilities. They just don't have the budgets to do this. You can't mandate this. And it eventually got blocked, and that bill died. So any legislation that we have seen that pressures critical infrastructure operators like power grid operators to up their security hasn't been legislation. It's come in the form of an executive order, first under the Obama administration and then under the Trump administration. But those are not very strong pieces of legislation. They lack real teeth. What they say is, we are just going to identify what is critical infrastructure, and the grid is critical infrastructure, and we're going to suggest that you use the following security standards and you keep your software patched, et cetera. And unfortunately, we are still nowhere near where we need to be.
We're speaking with journalist Nicole Pearl Roth. Her new book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends: The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking with journalist Nicole Pearl Roth, whose new book looks at the international market for software hacks and how governments buy and sell them. What tips do you have for staying safe online? Call us. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Nicole, we have a caller joining us now from Stevens Point, who I want to welcome in. Good morning, Saul.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. What's your question?
4 years ago, my taxes were hacked. I got a call from my accountant that said when she electronically submitted my forms that they had already been submitted. And so it took me 9 months to get my refund and lots of forms to fill out. But I just wanted to say, number one, it's become very common. They just need your Social Security and birth date, which are apparently not that hard to find. And the Wisconsin Department of Revenue was very helpful. Number one, you can actually talk to somebody. IRS is very difficult to talk to a person. But they were very helpful in terms of making sure that I had all the various forms, police report, and so on, filled out. So just a word of caution and advice.
Thank you. Thank you. Nicole, what are some of the... You must think about this so much and have to worry about protecting all of your work, all of your devices. Tax time is a common time that people can run into fraud and hacks. What advice do you have for us?
I'm just so sorry. I that is my nightmare, and I'm so happy that in Wisconsin, at least, they were helpful and that Saul is able to get that worked out. My advice is, there are some things you can control and there are some things you can't. And if someone has your Social Security number and your birthday, and those are readily captured by hackers and sold on the dark web, they can do exactly what Saul just described. So, be very careful about what information you're providing retailers in particular. Do they really need, more? Do they need your birth date? Do they need your home address? Probably, because you're going to have things shipped to you. But they probably don't need your Social Security number. So one thing is just be wary of who you're giving your personal information to. And then, again, it's the same advice I said earlier. Use really strong passwords for your email and your online banking account, and sites that would have your most sensitive information. Don't use those passwords for any other account and turn on two-factor authentication that anyone trying to hack into your bank account or email account from a strange device wouldn't be able to get in. And don't click on links and attachments, and be careful who you're giving your personal data to.
So what should the federal government be doing? What should we as a nation be doing to protect ourselves?
So many things.
3 minutes, you know, go.
I say in the book that we shouldn't just be hoarding every flaw we find, and we haven't been. We do have a process where we turn over flaws to software manufacturers like Microsoft. But in too many cases, we've learned that the federal government, intelligence agencies have held on to flaws for as long as 5 years in Microsoft software so they could preserve their counterintelligence operations. And, you know, the average length of time it takes for cyber criminals or nation states to discover a flaw in a system, a 0 day, is something like a year and change. So we should be turning those flaws over before that year expiration date, things like that. But I also do think it's time to take a look at where our market incentives have led us and to put in place liabilities for companies that do not secure their code, that do not update their software, that are using outdated software that's unsupported, that don't have two-factor authentication in place. We talked about the SolarWinds attack earlier, Molly. Well, we believe that Russian hackers used the SolarWinds software update as a Trojan horse to break into our federal agencies. And one of the things that came out in the course of discovering that attack and unwinding it was that the password to access SolarWinds software update mechanism was SolarWinds123.
No.
So I think it's time that we say, is that negligence? Because that software update mechanism allowed them to break into the Department of Homeland Security, you know, into our nuclear labs, into the Department of Energy, the Treasury, the Justice Department. So, you know, I think we need to seriously put in place carrots, but also consider some sticks for companies that basically, you know, operate our critical infrastructure, whose software makes it into our critical infrastructure.
Is this really how the world ends? Nicole Perl-Roth, thank you so much for joining us. The book was interesting, scary, but so important. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Molly. It was a joy.
Nicole Perl-Roth is a cybersecurity journalist for the New York Times. You're listening to The Morning Show, and I'm Molly Stenz. Show is produced by El Malik Anderson, Angelo Batista, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, Lauren Pavin, Stephen Potter, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Lee Rayburn, and I'm executive producer Molly Stenz.